any unfamiliar faces, but for those of you who are unfamiliar with me, I'm Garth Graham, the chairman of the board of directors of UCN. The subject of tonight's forum, which is on your information sheet that you were handed out, is future projections, and it's the first of two sessions on the future, and this one is on land and economics. And the next session will be post-settlement social change, and that will be held at F.H. Collins again, 7 o'clock next Sunday night. I'd like to begin tonight by introducing Paul Burkle, who's the executive director of CYI. And Paul has been with CYI for 3 years, and before that was 15 years with Yukon Electric. So we'll begin with Paul Burkle.
Thank you. I'm pleased to take this opportunity to speak to you about the word land and the often repeated phrase land claims. And I want to tell you about land from the Yukon Indian viewpoint. By starting with a brief historic description of the use Indians have made of land in the past and contrasting this with white European values and influences, some light can perhaps be shed on why we see land as we do and why this viewpoint may be different from your own. Having outlined the past traditional uses and values placed on land, I shall describe where we are today and the aspiration we as Indian people are working towards, always building on historic perspectives. In particular, the work the CYI is presently undertaking to research land and its potential will be touched on. Finally, looking ahead, I'll try to give you an idea on some of the land management areas we are investigating for the future. When Prime Minister Trudeau accepted the brief Together Today for Our Children Tomorrow in 1973, he was accepting what is in fact a claim for Indian land and Indian rights in the Yukon, a claim based on a philosophy of Aboriginal rights. So first, let us take a look at that term, Aboriginal rights. The Indian people were the first inhabitants of this area of Canada now called Yukon. Archaeologists working in the Old Crow region have found evidence of man dating back some 30,000 years. Our people live a nomadic life, traveling over large land areas as need and the seasons dictated in this one of the harshest climates in the world. Unlike the Indian people in the south or along the coast, we did not travel in large tribes, but rather in family groups of 10 or 15. This was because the land would not support more than that number of people at any one time. Because of the severe climate and a fragile balance of nature, we had to harvest nature's resource carefully in order to preserve it for the next year and the next generation. So we travel about using what we needed but never depleting the supply. In this way, a great amount of land was needed for our yearly travels. On occasion, we came together in larger groups for trading, potlatches, and fish camps. But basically, the yearly cycle consisted of fishing in the summer, hunting in the fall, trapping in the winter, and trading in the spring. All of the land was used from the river basin to the upper ranges of the mountains. Well-worn trails linked rivers, lakes, and trading centers. We knew the land intimately because our survival depended on this knowledge, and we took care of that land and its resources for the same reason, survival. Trade was carried on with the coastal tribes, and it was through these that Yukon Indians came into contact with the white man. First it was the Russians seeking furs, and then the Hudson Bay Company. Before long, our people were tied into a system where their economic life was tied to the white trader as well as to the land. The gold rush brought the first large numbers of strangers to the Yukon. 30,000 descended on Dawson City in search of gold. It had a devastating effect on the Indian people, not only in terms of disease to which we have no resistance, but also in that we were pushed, driven, or lured more and more away from the land. The missionaries came and residential schools were established which separated children from their family for up to 10 months of the year. Family breakdown and dislocation eventually followed as the children lost touch with their culture. They lost knowledge of the land and its ways because they were removed from it. The building of the Alaska Highway swelled the population of the Yukon. Whiters alone grew from 300 to 40,000. It brought about academics, alcoholism, illegitimacy, and a massive relocation of Indian villages away from traditional areas to new, conveniently selected government sites. Over the centuries, the Indian people of the Yukon have dealt with change, such as changes in game patterns, unpredictable weather, and outside influences by adapting to it. This had been our key to survival. However, less than 100 years ago, we found ourselves facing a situation where we could no longer live totally dependent on the land. Our lifestyle had been taken away and there was nothing to replace it. The difficulty many people have in understanding the importance of land to the Yukon Indian stems from a difference in attitudes towards land and its use. Based on cultural values and outlook, this difference is worth examining for a moment. The attitudes are deeply rooted. In the past, the Indian people lived, as I have described, off the land. Indeed, the land was our life. Every tribe of Indian people here in the Yukon, in Alaska, the Northwest Territories, and BC, we have all lived within a certain very large area. There were no set boundaries, but an understanding that each would not encroach into each other's territory. Within these territories, the land was shared amongst all the people for mutual benefit. It was not owned by specific persons. By contrast, white settlers coming into an area brought with them the belief that land could be owned, bought, and sold, and that it added to the wealth of an individual. Our people have always had a spiritual relationship with land. Because the land was our life, it had an importance akin to religion. Land was used carefully and with respect for the benefit of all, and then passed on to the children for future generation. Whites, originating from a European culture, believed in development, specialized goods, and industry, and had no direct link to land. As stated before, the Indian people formed themselves into small groups, using the land as need dictated and moving from place to place with the seasons. Whites, accustomed to concentrating in large numbers, lived on small areas of land in permanent settlements. The continuing thread of these values and attitudes can be seen to this day. Today, many of our people do not want to go back to the old way because it was a hard life, but at the same time, we believe we can plan a future that will not depend upon destroying that which is the basis of our culture, the land. Now let's look at where we are today. A land claim settlement is presently being negotiated with the federal government. A treaty has never been signed here between the Indian people and any government, so we are negotiating. The essence of the Yukon Indian settlement is to provide a means to an end. That end is the survival of the Yukon Indian people, the preservation of our life, and the means by which today's children can live in a changing world. A just settlement will permit Indians to control their future, both politically and economically. Unlike what has happened over the past 100 years, and the basis of that control is land. Without land, the Indian people have nothing. You can always make more money, you cannot make more land. With land, we can control our destiny and our future. Therefore, we are opposed to major development, such as a pipeline, until our claims have been settled and implemented. We want to be able to control any development on our land so that development does not jeopardize our other interests. Control of our land means control of our lives. Only in this way will we be able to take part in Canadian society, side by side with other Yukoners, free and equal. Self-determination is therefore strongly tied to the issue of land. But this is today, you may say. You have to deal with things the way things are done today. Well, first, let me say that the Indian people feel they should have a choice to either move into the mainstream of white society with its benefits or to live a largely traditional life close to the land. This is a big country. There is still room for everyone if we can only step up the proper system to handle whatever choices are made. And when you speak of dealing with the way things are today, I would like to point out a few facts of today that we are very much aware of, facts that did not exist 100 years ago. Influx of people has happened with the gold rush, Alaska Highway, and will occur with the pipeline. This means an expansion and entrenchment of southern political, economic, and social patterns. The Yukon Indian is already a minority in his land. We do not want to become an even smaller minority. The Yukon is no longer an unspoiled wilderness, as everyone here tonight knows. The Yukon River is badly polluted. The sewage of whiters is pumped into it daily. Game is declining. Outfitters have been able to take as many as 40 to 50 hunters into an area in 1 year, with no quota of big game taken. The herds are being depleted. In Old Crow, the caribou, whose behavior is unpredictable at the best of time, is threatened by the Dempster Highway and drilling on Eagle Plains, to mention a few. The people up there are almost totally Indian and totally dependent on the caribou for their food. Commercial fishing licenses on the upper Yukon River have had a drastic effect on the salmon. There are very few regulations and no catch limitation. In the Dawson area, those who have had traditional fishing sites have been moved off these mainly because of the large amount of new commercial license issued. The subsistence yield is now very poor. The Chinook run to the McClintock River is all but gone. The run at Teslin is almost dead. These facts are an indication of damage done and growing as the years pass. We as Indian people are worried because we see these things happening to our land. We see the need for controls and insurance that some of the land and its resources will be saved for us and our children and their children. So we are negotiating a land claim settlement. The first task in attempting to settle the claim is to select land we want and need. While the method of land selection has not yet been definitely decided upon, we have divided land into four categories based on use. These are land to live on, land for traditional use, historic sites, and land for economic development. Land to live on will consist of land selected for the purposes of residence. Much of this land will be in and surrounding the existing communities in the Yukon. Land for traditional use will likely be tracts of land set aside where Indian people can continue the traditional pursuit of hunting, fishing, and trapping, undisturbed by developments which would otherwise reduce the game supply. Historic sites include burial grounds, spirit houses, fish camps such as at Tluxiu, and similar areas that have a historic significance to Yukon Indian people. These are the lands we wish to preserve and protect. Unfortunately, as in the case of spirit houses in the past, these historic Indian sites have been abused, neglected, or made into tourist attractions. Land for economic development refers to land with present or future potential for development, mineral deposit, both surface and subsurface, forestry, commercial, fishing, and so on. These are all come under economic development. Through this type of land use, the Indian people would have an opportunity to gain an equal footing with a dominant white society. Yukon Indians are not opposed to development, but we want to have a say over the type and method used in this development. Some of our people wish to remain on the land, and some wish to take part in Canada's economic society. We not only want to share in its benefits of the development, such as royalties, we also want to take part in the planning of those developments. In this way, we will be able to determine the nature and the rate of development based on our people's needs and wishes. The terms of development must be acceptable to the Indian people. The land claims is coming at a time when the Yukon is entering a state of rapid economic development. The Indian people want to be able to take advantage of the opportunities that development can provide. The pipeline is the first thing that springs to mind, and it will bring opportunities to those people prepared for its impact and able to take advantage of its effects. But it is a double-edged sword with many disadvantages, both definite and possible, that all Yukoners, and especially the Indian people, can already see. The pipeline, while it is a major one, is not the only development on the horizon. Dams, new mines, highway construction, the potential is here. The next question is, who presently owns the land? At this time, the vast majority of the land in Yukon is federal crown land. Some have been transferred over to the territory and municipal governments, and some is in private hands. But for the most part, it is under federal control. During our land selection, we will be trying, where possible, to avoid land where there is already prior interest. However, it is, of course, likely that specific cases may arise where there will be some conflict over the land. We will have to deal with these individually as they arise. We have set out the four categories of land based on the uses to which we will want to put that land. Next, we require as much information as possible in order to be able to choose those areas most suitable to the desired uses. The COI has accumulated a great deal of information on land resources. This information is contained in maps, surveys, questionnaires, and studies. It will be very helpful in land selection. We have, for example, mapped the information on prior interests, both surface and subsurface claims. This includes all tidal property, the locations of local improvement districts, residential leases, agricultural leases, oil and gas permits, mineral leases, game sanctuaries, territorial and national parks. In the area of resources, both renewable and non-renewable, we have maps on mineral occurrences, merchantable timber stands, oil and gas reserves, areas of hydro potential, fish areas, trapline locations, and areas of game. We are also compiling maps on ancestral use, which outline traditional hunting and fishing areas. Indian place names are being researched and put to the areas of historic significance to the Indian people. This covers almost the total Yukon. Ordinarily, there were Indian names for every place of importance here. These names identified locations by their use, by an important event which has taken place there, or by outstanding geographical feature of the land. It was only after the arrival of the white man that most of these names fell into disuse and were replaced by ones named by the government. COI researchers have documented how the land and its resources have been used over the years in much the same way as the maps detail the type and locations of the land resources. All this information is now going to the Indian people and the communities so that they will be able to make informed decisions where land has been selected. The land chosen will be put together in a total package of a final settlement negotiated with the federal government. Once the land has been selected, there must be in place a system of management whereby the Indian people can be assured that they, in fact, use the land for the reasons they selected. This means safeguards, management, and controls. Here, the issue is complicated by the problem of overlapping authorities. After the settlement is reached, the Indian people will regain certain lands on which they will have complete government control, subject only to the sovereign rights of the Government of Canada. Possible conflicts between areas which are within the jurisdiction of a territorial government, such as zoning bylaws, are bound to arise. However, it is hoped that by the time a settlement has been worked out, all these considerations will have been taken into account and a solution found. Land not under direct Indian control will also have to be managed, and our people want to be certain that they will have a definite voice in how this is done. After all, land is like a river that all joins and runs together, each piece into the next. What happens in any one area will affect the whole. The method used to guarantee Indian input into land management has not yet been decided upon. There are many possibilities. Local tribunals and Indian representation on advisory boards are two examples. However, as our experience in the past has shown, that advisory boards have no real power and the recommendations are often ignored. We will be very careful when we settle on an agreed method of land management. I realize that there are probably many questions I have left unanswered. This is because I can't give you a specific answers while the settlement is still in the formative stage. We cannot say for certain at this time what choices and methods will finally be agreed upon. What I've tried to do here tonight is to give you a basic understanding of what our ties to land have been over the past centuries, and how these ties were changed, and what we hope to achieve from a land claim settlement to make up for past grievances and gain a foothold on the future. I've tried to show you how the Indian people feel about our land and give you a picture of the areas we are thinking about. If I have succeeded, then you should be able to see the direction in which we are working. That direction is towards self-sufficiency and self-control, so that we will be able to join with you in making the Yukon the best possible place for us all to live together. And we believe that the basis for that equality and freedom of choice is land. Thank you.
Our next speaker will be Ian Mackay, who is a managing partner of a firm of chartered accountants in Whitehorse and the president of the Whitehorse Chamber of Commerce. As far as a background in Native organizations is concerned, he's also the auditor for YNB, Yancey, and CYI. And Ian will be speaking on the hopes and problems of Yukon businessmen with the forthcoming settlement.
Thanks, Garth. Firstly, I'd like to congratulate the University of Canada North for sponsoring this series of meetings. And I'd like to thank them for asking me here tonight to give some of the views of businessmen as they see the land claim settlement coming. Businessmen in the territory are very concerned with and interested in the eventual settlement terms of the Yukon Indian land claims. These concerns are basically of two kinds. The first one is of the short-term impacts of the settlement. If it can be assumed, in addition to land, the Indian people will receive a substantial amount of cash, royalty rights, and perhaps taxation advantages, and each one of these items will have a direct effect upon the other businesses in the territory. I'd like to deal with cash first. A large amount of cash will have the effect of increasing dramatically the spending power of the Indian people, either in groups, bands, or as individuals. It's not hard to imagine how the businessmen feel about that. However, the treasury of the Indian organizations will also give them enormous economic power. And we're concerned that that power is used wisely, not only for the Indian people, but for their neighbors also. It's important for all of us to understand, that economically we are interdependent. To be specific, I'd like to give you an example of what could be a problem coming up. Take a small town like Teslin, where there's one general store serving the whole community. The size of that community and its economic base pretty well dictate that only one store can survive economically. Now, say that an Indian family decide that with a loan or a grant from their band, they want to get into the general store business. They have a choice of one, buying the existing business, or two, starting up a new store in competition. The temptation is to open a new one, especially if there's been a feeling that the existing store has been exploiting its monopoly situation. But the answer is, of course, the existing store would have to be bought. because if not, both businesses will suffer. There's only enough business for one store. Now, if they go into competition with each other, each one will suffer. And on the one side, you'll have bitterness on the part of the old owners of the business, being put out of their living by competition, supported ultimately by the taxpayers' dollars, their own dollars. The other effect on the Indian side is for that business to have a very difficult time to get going. And they really don't need a very difficult time to get going. You want to pick better situations, and failure is not where you want to start. So in summary, the cash should be used to promote Indian enterprise, I feel, filling in existing gaps in the economy or buying existing successful enterprises. As a businessman, I would favor the latter because it's a lot safer. But don't expect to make a lot of money out of the businesses, because the businesses in the Yukon that I'm aware of, especially in the outlying communities, are not big dollar makers. They're survival. So it's not a great big bonanza to go out and be made. The economy is not going to just double overnight. That's one of the concerns about cash. Now, royalty rights, this is a very sensitive area. We do not know at present what, if any, royalty rights may come to the Indian people through the settlement. But I'd like to point out a few economic facts of life with respect to the mining industry. It's a very high risk, capital intensive, and delicately balanced industry. Canada is fortunate in having many smaller mines in operation, which in many other parts of the world would be too small to start. Whitehorse Copper is a good example of this. The reason these small mines operate in Canada is that there is a system of tax incentives from the government of Canada and a stable economic and political process, which make it attractive for large mining companies to invest in Canada and in the smaller mines. Now, the Yukon mining is and will be the backbone of the economic life of this territory. Right now, we're looking at one mine closing in 1978 and two others walking a very narrow path between profit and loss. We need new mines, and in fact, several ore bodies have already been found. One of the factors that will determine whether these new mines will open will be the royalty rates that they'll be required to pay. As businessmen, we are concerned that royalties negotiated in the land claim settlement don't put such an upward pressure on costs that new mines in Yukon will not be opened. If that happens, there'll be no royalties and no economy. Now, taxation advantages. There's two areas of surface in this. If the Indian corporations are farmed and have tax-exempt status, or Indian employees have tax-exempt status, the company will have a tremendous competitive edge and will be subsidized by the very people with whom they're in competition. I don't think that's particularly fair, and it would do enormous harm to the relationship between the peoples of the territory. The other concern is that in the long run, tax advantages are just another form of subsidy and a form of welfare that defeats the whole objective of a land claim settlement. So I think that kind of thing should be thrown out on principle. Now, on the land, just one general comment. I think it should be looked upon as a base for economic growth in the future. I think the trapping and hunting and so forth will continue, but I think that the Indian people should be looking very much at selecting land that will give them an economic base in terms of the white society rather than the terms of their former way of life. I think that's a fact of life. Now, looking at the longer term aspects of the settlement, I'd like to outline why most businessmen who support the settlement feel it will be beneficial to all. A settlement, no matter what the terms, will remove business's biggest enemy. That enemy is uncertainty. Not knowing what the future will bring, where basic things are under negotiation, like land, subsurface rights, taxation, future competition, this is the effect of paralyzing economic activity. We have faced this uncertainty now for the period of the negotiations since 1973. And if you ask any businessman what his main concern now is with land claims, is that he'd like to get it settled and soon. We expect that the settlement will be the biggest boon to the territory from a business viewpoint since the gold rush. It's been said that in Alaska, the settlement has had a far greater impact than the recently completed pipeline. If that is so in Alaska, then it's obviously true in Yukon. In handling this, the Yukon people will have great opportunities to better their lot. However, we hope that as businessmen, we will be asked to help, advise, and cooperate. I don't mean just local businessmen, I do mean that you will need expert help. Experts are expensive, but they should pay for themselves easily by the value of their services. Don't go for the cheapest, because he probably isn't the best. And the best experts in finance, technology, legal, and management matters is what is going to be needed. There's going to be an enormous amount of money and management problems arising. Another impact, long-term impact, and this is a touchy one, may be the elimination of discrimination. That discrimination exists, make no mistake about that. And nobody likes it. But a lot of that discrimination derives from a dislike of rich people by poor people, and poor people by rich people. It's exaggerated in Yukon by the fact that most of the rich people are white, and a lot of the Indian people are poor. So if the land claim succeeds in leveling these differences in economic status, it may very well succeed in leveling and putting away discrimination. The principle behind the settlement in the eyes of businessmen is to correct an imbalance between the benefits that we as whites enjoy from our way of life and the much less amount of benefits enjoyed by the Indian people. Complicating this is that the white society has placed high values on individual enterprise, pulling up by our own bootstraps and self-reliance. Many successful businessmen feel quite rightly they have earned their way of life by their own efforts. It is therefore hard for them to understand what good the welfare system will do people. The land claim settlement is, in the eyes of business, therefore, perhaps a way of breaking out of the welfareism that exists. It's like a young man obtaining an inheritance and using the capital to better himself by starting new businesses, furthering his education, or making sure his children have equal opportunity. In summary, we feel that if a land claim brings about equal opportunity, then its purpose is achieved. This, we recognize, may not come in the immediate future. Perhaps our children will begin to see it. Together today for our children tomorrow says it all.
Thank you, Ian. Our next speaker is Emil Naughty, Fairbanks, Alaska. He is a senior vice president with Doyon Limited, one of the 12 regional corporations set up under Alaskan land claims. And he was the first president of the Alaska Federation of Natives during the land claims effort, and a deputy commissioner of the State of Alaska Health and Social Services Division. And he's going to talk on land claims impact in Alaska.
Thank you. This makes about five times I've been back here to Whitehorse or somewhere in Canada to talk about land claims, and I must enjoy it because I can't seem to say no to the invitation to come down and talk. So I am glad to be here, and I do appreciate the invitation to come on down. I'll limit my remarks to the experiences in Alaska, and as far as I can, to limit them to the impact of land claims. I don't know the Canadian laws, and if there are any parallels or if any lessons can be learned from impact on Alaska, someone else will have to draw the conclusions. I'll just talk about the experiences that we have had. It's very difficult to try to separate the land claims impact from the impact of the pipeline. They happened about the same time, or one happened because of the other, in some people's opinions. But when we talk about the impact, what I think we're really talking about is change. And the two changes that I want to talk about are social change and economic change. The social change comes about because, mainly because of influx of people. And the changes that do happen are the old lifestyle disappears, subsistence changes because the game populations and the migration patterns change, and the populations go down, and they will not support the number of hunters, whether sportsmen or subsistence. And the growth comes mainly in the area of sportsmen. And sometimes sportsmen, you can put in quote, because they're not really sportsmen. Lifestyle changes, education changes. There will be changes in housing, and culture and language. One of the systems that brings the greatest change to the villages is a road system. And in Alaska, there's almost unanimous opposition to roads. The villages just do not want a road system connecting the villages with the cities. And I'm amazed a lot of times to hear people say, I wonder where the number of people are coming into Alaska from. And it's always easy for me to see where they're coming from. And some of you may have heard my numbers before, but I'll risk repeating them again. When we look at America by the year 2000, we're talking of 300 million people. And that's 22 years from now. We're sitting there over there with 220 million people. And that means in the next 22 years, 80 million people more in America. That's eight cities the size of Los Angeles in place just to take care of new people. New houses, new sewer systems, new electrical generators, new roads, new schools, new police departments, cities in place. Now, that means every year about three cities the size of three cities the size of Seattle. And Alaska has timber and energy and land and minerals and all of the opportunities that people move towards. So we can expect, I think, in Alaska, a greater percentage of growth than the rest of America. And I'm not sure this holds, but if Canada grows at the same rate as the United States, it means that in the same period of time, by the year 2000, you'll have in place 20 cities the size of Calgary just to handle new people. And I think the parallel is there. You have discoveries of gas, and you have timber, and you have water, clean air, and land, minerals. That all adds up to opportunity, and people will come to opportunity. So I think it's fair to say that you will have substantial growth in the Yukon Territory. Now, on the economic side, the land claims in Alaska, I don't think the money part compares with the pipeline. For 200,000 acres of land in the North Slope, the state of Alaska got $900 million for a lease. Plus, they'll get royalties on top of that. The native people of Alaska were able to sell 330 million acres of land to the federal government for $962 million. And hang on to about 10% of the landmass, 40 million acres. So in terms of money, the money impact of land claims does not compare with the pipeline, in my opinion, because besides the 900 million, they spent another, $8 or $10 billion to build the pipeline. And then we start getting royalties off of 2 million barrels a day. So the money impact does not compare in magnitude in any way to the pipeline. And on an individual basis, it's even less. There's been to date $340 million paid into regional corporations in Alaska. They were required the first 5 years to pass on 10% to their shareholders. $27 million, it turns out to be, passed on to individuals. And that ranged with 80,000 stockholders. You can do the arithmetic. It wasn't very much, especially over the years. The biggest payment in any 1 year was around $1,000. So the money change, you know, did not make any substantial difference in the lifestyles of Native people in Alaska. And when you look at the corporations, that means $5,000 is passed per individual into the corporations, and that was split half to the village corporation and half into the regional corporations. And so the regional corporations are set there at about $2,000 or a little more per individual. And out of that $2,000, picture yourself with an investment of $2,000 into a company. What are your returns going to be, even if you're profit making? If you declared a dividend on profit of a $2,000 investment, you can see that you know, you're going to make $20 to $50 a year, maybe, if you're making money. And the regional corporations, by and large, have not made money in the short period of time they've been in existence. It just takes time to start an investment and get some money coming back. So on an individual basis, the impact has been minimal. The impact of the regions on the economy of Alaska, of course, has made some difference. And in some areas, it's been important impact. But the impact, by and large, has been in the cities, Anchorage and Fairbanks and Nome and Kotzebue, where the office buildings went in and the hotels were built. And so the impact of the economics from the regional corporations in aggregate has made a difference. But even the corporations themselves, there's a lot of fear about what the corporations were going to do and going into businesses and competing and all. But, you know, even the biggest corporation is a very small corporation when you compare it to some of the big corporations that are moving in, the national and the multinational corporations that are moving into Alaska. Just done an exploration program. We had three dry holes looking for oil on our land. And the company that went in there spent more money on that exploration program than we will receive under land claims. Risk money, pure throwaway money, speculation, exploration, looking for oil. We could never afford to go into that kind of an exploration program. And they're going to walk away from there if they don't find anything and go about their business. So as much money as $900 million sounds, when you break it down to the village corporations, the 200 village corporations, and then the 12 regional corporations, are not large by business standards. And even if they're successful in making money, which all of them have not been to date, the dividends to the individual are going to be small, and they will not make a substantial impact on lifestyles. And when we get into the land holdings of the regional corporation, that's where the long-term benefits are going to be. Being the single largest private landholders in Alaska, the corporations are, they have to date at least 10 dry holes looking for oil. Now, that has to be a benefit. I don't know the numbers, but there must be at least $100 million spent on exploration by oil companies on native lands. And by and large, the money did not go to the native corporation, it went into labor. And most of the labor pool came from other places than the villages. We were successful in getting some village people into building the support system of airports and roads and moving gravel around and supporting the drilling crews out there. But by and large, the drilling crews were not native people. But the impact of having private lands opened up for development has to be important to the state of Alaska. And that, in the future, I think, is where the biggest impact will be. There's a lot of interest in native lands, not only oil and gas, but hard rock minerals. I would say tens of millions of dollars have been spent on exploration for hard rock minerals in the last 5 years on native lands. And we have negotiated some pretty tough agreements. I think the state government and federal government in Alaska anyway have given away the resources. You know, 12.5% is a standard royalty. We were able to negotiate a much higher percentage. Of course, we made some concessions. We told the oil companies they wouldn't have to pay us very much until they got their investment back. But after they got paid for all the exploration and the investment for getting the oil out, we wanted 50% of whatever was left, and they were willing to go for that. And that exploration has a built-in conflict, because what it means is the villagers, by and large, want to protect their lifestyle. They don't want a lot of newcomers running through the villages, and they don't want a lot of the things that the cities bring and the lifestyle of the cities. So that's the conflict. On the one hand, you have regional corporations that are faced with paying taxes in a few years and having to get profitable ventures going so they can pay taxes. And the state government is looking at that land and just trying to pass a statewide property tax, because right now the only people who can tax land are cities and boroughs. And most of the native land claims land is outside of either a city or a borough, so the state of Alaska is saying, we're going to tax that land. And they're trying to pass a statewide property tax. So the regional corporations are trying to get some development so they can pay the taxes. And that puts them in conflict with the village lifestyle. And the big difference in Alaska in the land claims compared to the reservation system in America is that we were faced with paying taxes after 1991 on developed lands. The land claims in Alaska, in many ways, is a great experiment. You know, Congress, for the last couple hundred years, of every year, here's the Bureau of Indian Affairs come back and testify for money for Indian people in America, because they have bad housing and poor health and underachievement in education and high unemployment. And year after year, Congress passes millions of dollars to take care of those problems. And they're always there the next year. So they're trying something different in Alaska. So in many ways, it's a social experiment to change Indian people from hunters and gatherers to entrepreneurs. And it's a challenge that only time will tell whether it's successful. At the proper time, I'll be glad to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Emil. Thank you for coming back 5 times, and perhaps we'll get even further opportunity. Our next speaker is Bill Weber, who is the president of the Yukon Association of Non-Status Indians. Bill was born and raised in Whitehorse, and he's been involved with Indian organizations since the founding of Yancey in 1971 in various volunteer capacities. And he's been president of Yancey for the past 3 years. He's worked in construction industry in many areas, including in his own business. He wants to talk about options for post-land claims socioeconomic development. Bill?
Thank you, Garth. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased to be invited here this evening to talk about the Yukon Indian socioeconomic post-settlement options. It's such a broad issue that I certainly have lots of room to move around in. I have to say that there are still a number of variables and unknowns in exactly what we will accomplish in a land claim settlement. We, of course, are very optimistic that it will meet our future needs. Development has to be well planned in all respects. Social, environmental, and economic goals must be looked at collectively and achieved with respect to proper balance with one another. Since the gold rush, the economy of Yukon has been dominated by non-renewable resource extraction. All of the social disorders caused by the kind of boom-bust development that has occurred in Yukon due to mineral exploration and findings need not be repeated. First and foremost, our main goal, put simply, is that the Indian people of Yukon want to become the beneficiaries of development rather than its victims. To accomplish this is going to mean a number of different thrusts. There has to be a balance struck between both renewable and non-renewable resource development. There have to be development options maintained for both individuals and communities. And Indian people must be in a position to control developments that will affect them. Indian people must be able to participate in the ownership of development projects, and of course, social development must go hand in hand with economic development. At present and in the past, there has been a dual economy in Yukon. For example, traditional economic activities, as well as large-scale resource extraction projects. The resource extraction projects since 1896 have dominated the economy to the detriment of renewable resource activities. This has served to bias government and public opinion regarding development in Yukon. Here are four misconceptions that this bias produces. One, that only large-scale resource extraction projects are feasible in Yukon. Two, the renewable resource development of any kind is not feasible or efficient. Three, the traditional Indian way of life, because it is based upon renewable resource activities, is no longer viable. Four, that growth of resource extraction and government service portions of the economy are the equivalent of development. The Indian people of Yukon have rejected these false truths and have proposed that a balanced economy with Indian participation be pursued. This was stated in our initial land claims position paper, Together Today for Our Children Tomorrow. Interestingly, Mr. Berger agreed with us, the LISIC inquiry agreed with us, and in August of this year, the Science Council of Canada agreed with us in their report, number 26, Northward Looking, A Strategy and Science Policy for Northern Development. The present resource extraction-based economy has served to limit the development options that are open to Indian people, and for that matter, to all Yukoners. Either you join the wage economy as an employee of the government resource extraction sectors, or you take welfare. This has never been acceptable to Indian people. One, because it did not allow them to pursue those traditional economic activities that were part of their culture. And two, because they could never comprehend taking from the land and putting nothing back. And three, because they knew from experience that other development activities were possible. The mixed economy that Indian people propose would encourage individual effort. Small businesses set up to meet the needs of Yukoners, agriculture, small-scale forestry, fur harvesting, local housing construction, tourism, as well as mining and government service. This broad-based economic program that we propose must certainly sound ambitious. We recognize this, and we also recognize that we as Indian people have a lot to learn in a very short period of time, and a lot of adjusting to do if we are to take control of our future. This is why we are proposing social development programs and cultural development programs that will support our economic development ideas. What we are doing now is attempting to identify for ourselves what our social and cultural needs are, both as individuals and as communities. Once we have done this, we intend to develop programs in cooperation with government to assist our people in developing themselves socially and culturally so that they can then benefit more substantially from economic development projects. In some cases, our social-cultural programs will precede economic development. In some cases, social-cultural programs will be pursued in parallel with economic development. And on occasion, economic development may begin prior to starting up the social-cultural programs. But in any case, social and cultural development will be pursued along with economic development in order that we can maximize the benefits and minimize the impacts that are passed along to our people. There has been much discussion in recent years about people having a say about the development that takes place in the territory. In some cases, we've all had a chance to express our opinions about development, but that's all we had. In other words, our thoughts have counted for nothing, and the government has gone ahead and done whatever it pleases. Unfortunately, because of this, we feel that this is as far as public participation will ever take us, whether we are Indian or non-Indian. We feel that there has to be something more substantial put into place if economic development is to continuously benefit the people of Yukon. There has to be public control of economic development. Contrary to what many people might think, it is not the intention of the Indian through a control mechanism to prevent economic development from taking place. We recognize that development must occur. However, there is no longer any reason why it should take place at the expense of Indian people, at the expense of the natural environment, and at the expense of the future development options of our children. Indian ownership or financial participation in economic ventures has an obvious meaning: money for Indian people. This is important to us, as you might well imagine, but it should be equally important to every Yukoner. With the present development situation, most of the profits from economic ventures, particularly those of any significant size, usually get exported to the south along with the slightly processed resource. These ventures usually create a few jobs and some small profits for Yukon businesses, but not much else. Imagine, however, what might happen to the economic picture of Yukon if suddenly the big profits started staying here. It's pretty obvious that any activity, organization, or event that could successfully divert the southward flow of profits would make a big contribution to Yukon and all Yukoners.
Thank you, Bill. Our last speaker is Dr. Peter Usher. P.J. Usher Consulting Services. He's a socioeconomic consultant with Northern research experience since 1962. He has his Ph.D. in geography, and the thesis was the trapping economy of Banks Island. He's had 10 years experience with the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development, and he's been a private consultant since 1972. Chiefly in the Western Arctic, related to native land use and occupancy and the socioeconomic impact of pipelines. He's been Ottawa-based since December of 1976. Peter?
Well, I think the first thing I should say, being here in the Yukon, out of many years knocking around the north, only about 2 weeks of it have been in the Yukon. In some circles that might qualify me as an expert, but I think not really. And so I want to say right at the outset that what I want to, the kinds of ideas that I want to talk about tonight are really based on my experience in other parts of the north, and their applicability to the Yukon you will have to judge for yourself. In looking at the role of renewable resources in the future of the North, I think that in the last 20 or so years, a great number of wrong ideas have cropped up as to what is really happening with the use of renewable resources by Native people. I think at the individual level, people who come to the North, outsiders who come to the North, see Native people essentially in towns. They see them driving taxis and skidoos and outboard motors and so on. They see them wearing clothing that's not very far out of the ordinary. They don't hear about all these exotic things that they learned as a child. And they say, oh, well, Native people must be just like us. They've really changed then. The land really isn't very important to them at all. And what's all this business about land claims? That must be just some kind of a political stunt, because obviously they're holding down jobs, or some of them are, and therefore all this land business is really... I'm painting a bit of an extreme picture, but perhaps a lot of you will recognize that position, that many people who come to the North and observe the situation solely from a place like Yellowknife or Whitehorse or Frobisher Bay are easily led to believe. I think perhaps more important than that, policymakers, federal government, and I think territorial and provincial administrations in the North as well, have, by responding to what was a very real crisis in the Native economy about 25 years ago, came also to some wrong conclusions. It was supposed that on the correct premise that the only resources which could make a major contribution to the gross national product of Canada were indeed the mines, oil, and gas resources of the North and such like, it was then assumed that the only future for Native people lay in becoming fully involved with the winning of those resources, and that the old economy was dead. Given the fact that the old economy was dead, governments decided that the short-run solution was welfare and health measures and so on. In the long run, they were education and employment, training for employment in the industrial economy, which was sure to come. Well, you know, lots of people believed this. Policymakers believed it. Administrators believed it. Social scientists such as myself believed it at one time. And obviously, Native people somewhere along the line weren't listening to the experts. Because in recent years, research on land use and occupancy and the Native use of resources has revealed some interesting things. For example, that the extent in area of Native land use in certainly in many parts of the far north is just as great now as it ever was. That the total amount of food being harvested from the land is probably greater now, I mean human food, is probably greater now than it was 25 years ago. That the value of the fur harvest is probably greater now than it was 25 years ago. Let me give you some figures from the Mackenzie Valley in Western Arctic. Approximately 3.5 million pounds of food harvested. Average 240 pounds per capita per year, with a replacement value of $726 a year. Those figures are not out of line. If you look at research, much better documented research in northern Quebec, you find 327 pounds food production per capita by the Cree of northern Quebec, and over 1,000 pounds per capita by the Inuit of northern Quebec. Now, that's not all human food. When we look at these standard impact studies and analyses of the Native economy in the North, which says, well, people are essentially poor, they're unemployed. They're only unemployed because you're measuring it in terms of the measurements that... We use measurements designed to test the performance of our industrial economy in the South. We apply these to an economy which bears very little relationship to that, and our conclusions are biased by using those measures. We conclude that people are unemployed so long as they are not actually in a wage-earning position 52 weeks of the year. We conclude that if people only earn so much cash per capita, we come to these amazingly low figures, and we wonder, how is it that people can actually survive? You know, you read of things like $200 per capita per year, or these amazing figures, and you think, my God, these people must be starving and freezing. Well, when you realize that a great deal of production of benefit to Native people is things that they produce which they do not sell, which do not enter into the marketplace. That, I think, alters our perception of what's really going on. So what I'm suggesting to you is that, and I don't know the specific figures in the Yukon and how well these would apply, except to say that in every jurisdiction in which the traditional economy has been subject to a proper reanalysis, the contribution of the traditional resources and the dependence of Native people on those resources is always higher, much higher, than has previously been thought. Now, if that's the case, then people are obviously not poverty-stricken and unemployed and waiting all these thousands of years for the Metropolitan Society of Canada to come along and give them jobs out of kindness. All this, of course, is not to deny that some very great changes have occurred in Native society and in Native economy. But this false picture of the traditional economy and on Native people, and all I'm talking about here is Native people's economic reliance on the land. All this pays no attention to the social and cultural importance of the land and its resources to them. What this false economic picture has led us to believe, outsiders to believe, is that there must only be two choices for Native people, either to join in the industrial economy as industry and government have planned it, or to turn the clock back, go back to the Stone Age. Well, I think these are false choices. I never, in all the years I lived in the Western Arctic, I never heard anybody talking about wanting to go back to the Stone Age. Well, and let me offer one more fact, because we hear about greatly exploding populations and rising expectations and so on, and how everybody can't go running back to the land, aside from the fact that nobody's suggesting that everybody go back to the land. In most parts of the Northwest Territories, if not of the Yukon, I don't know the situation here, the Native population is now probably about the same as it was 100 years ago. So that, in fact, the idea that there are a tremendous increase in the number of Native people and they couldn't possibly live on the resources that are there, that statement is simply not true. We look at recent population increases and fail to go back far enough to see what the situation really was at one time. Now, what then does this mean for the future? I think first it means that these resources are capable of sustaining, of providing, making a significant economic contribution to, they make a significant economic contribution to the North at present. They are capable of making a very significant economic contribution to the North in the future on a sustained yield basis. That is, they can last forever if properly managed. They can provide the basis for much smaller scale developments under local control, community-based and community-controlled enterprises, which are not dependent on market conditions far away, on the whims of people from the outside who find it convenient to come here at certain times, but also to go away at certain times. And I am not suggesting merely a continuation of a subsistence economy. I think that the renewable resources of the North provide a basis for development which we have not yet seen in the North, which has occasionally been tried with very mixed success, but I think has nonetheless significant potential for the future. And that is in the marketing and processing of these resources beyond simply the subsistence sector, because although these resources are of value, there will be in the future, and always has been really, a problem of capitalization for renewable resource-based enterprises. You can't go hunting for nothing anymore. You can't go trapping for nothing. And it has always been a problem of the primary producer, just as indeed it is for primary producers in the South, for farmers, to obtain sufficient capitalization for these enterprises. And if we look at larger scale enterprises beyond the family level, we see greater capitalization problems. If we are looking at sawmills, tanneries, food processing, garment manufacturing, house building, a range of activities that are open, agriculture, whatever, all these things require capital. And I think that there's no question that sector of the renewable resource-based sector of the economy now does not provide sufficient capital for its own continued development, let alone to satisfy all the needs of all the people. So that's a problem that has to be overcome. But the potential is there. The significance of all this, I think, is that it is not a choice between that, you know, that this traditional economy, the renewable resource-based economy, is something that will die away to be replaced by industrial employment. It seems to me that what an awful lot of people want in the North is to be able to participate in both, and that it isn't jobs or hunting, it's jobs and hunting. We know now that many, as I said before, the hunting and trapping costs money, or hunting alone costs money. You can feed your family very well, but it costs money to go and do it. And a lot of people get their money for that now by going and working. And the increased mobility that people have by virtue of snowmobiles and boats and so on allows them to do both. Most people, most native people, I think, feel that employment is necessary, but that it must be compatible with continued use of the traditional resources, and that those resources must make a very major contribution to the northern economy in the future, as they do now, although it's largely unrecognized, the contribution that they make now. The possibilities are there. Of that, I think there can be no question, but the problems are also there. I've mentioned the capitalization problem. That can be solved either I think one of the areas that it will not be solved through is in the generation of personal savings of Northerners. I don't think by and large that's going to provide either the amount or the organization of capital, the accumulation in one place to finance many of these ventures. Now, the relation of all this to land claims is that developments which take place in the non-renewable sector may well be able to provide the capital to get these kinds of enterprises going. Some may in future be able to be self-sustaining, having been given that initial injection of capital. Some may not. Some may have overriding social and cultural values that it is considered necessary to continue to inject funds from other sectors of the economy into those. I think that if we look at the ways in which these enterprises have failed in the past, very small-scale attempts at such development, certainly in the far north, undercapitalization was one, outside control was another, and a very important one, that the objectives of the enterprise were never clearly defined, either in the minds of policymakers themselves, let alone to the people who were to participate in those enterprises. And I think that if these resources are to become of even greater benefit to native people than they are now, then their development must be under the control of native people. And that land claim settlements will have to have provisions which ensure that that happens. These resources, after all, are considered by native people in most areas to be their resources. The problem of access to these resources is certainly going to be a question. Most land claim settlements in the north seek to enshrine traditional hunting and fishing rights. In short, people's access to those resources, if not to the absolute control of management of those resources, certainly to the access. If development of these resources is going to be placed on a much more successful basis than has happened in the past, it will, I think there are several criteria. One being the question of native control, of local control of the enterprise. The other is that there must be a favorable climate for these types of enterprises, that they are not seen as make work, as subsidies, as improper competition to white businesses, and so on. That we are not merely devising band-aid solutions to the prosecution of the traditional economy, to trapping and hunting and so on, that small-scale loans. You see, if you don't capitalize things properly, that's one, in my mind, a very sure prescription for failure. And I think that if we look at many of these enterprises in the past, have not been properly capitalized. It's no wonder they've failed. Therefore, band-aid solutions won't work. There has to be a commitment to this kind of development, and I think it's a commitment that really only native people can make. If that's what they want, they'll make that commitment. But then they must be given a reasonably free hand to do that and to call upon the resources and expertise that they need, but not have these things subjected to government control and all the bureaucratic red tape and so on that has bedeviled similar enterprises in the past. It's a pretty large subject. I could probably go on a bit, but I think it's probably better to break it off for the discussion groups, but I really want to emphasize how much we have underestimated the potential of that sector of the economy, how important it is to the future, and that the possibilities are there, and we should not be trapped by thinking in terms of these false choices which leave out a very great and important development potential in the north. This obviously is not true for the Yukon now that you have a pipeline, but in the Mackenzie, obviously people are going to have to rely on their own resources. And the failure in people's thinking is to think that there is no resources there. There are. Why haven't they been developed all this time? I think it's a failure of imagination certainly in government policy, if government is incapable of overcoming that failure, then perhaps Native people are capable of overcoming it.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you to all five of our panelists. As we did in the last two programs, tonight we are going to now break into discussion groups, and we'll come back and have a question period following that.